This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Why Nations Fail, The Origins of Power, Prosperity, and Poverty by Darren Acemoglu and James Robinson. Read for you by Dan Warren. Publisher's note. The narrator references charts throughout this recording, which can be viewed by opening the accompanying digital PDF file on any PC or Mac computer. Preface. This book is about the huge differences in incomes and standards of living that separate the rich countries of the world, such as the United States, Great Britain, and Germany, from the poor, such as those in sub-Saharan Africa, Central America, and South Asia. As we write this preface, North Africa and the Middle East have been shaken by the Arab Spring, started by the so-called Jasmine Revolution, which was initially ignited by public outrage over the self-immolation of a street vendor, Mohamed Bouzazi, on December 17, 2010. By January 14, 2011, President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, who had ruled Tunisia since 1987, had stepped down. But far from abating, the revolutionary fervor against the rule of privileged elites in Tunisia was getting stronger and had already spread to the rest of the Middle East. Hosni Mubarak, who had ruled Egypt with a tight grip for almost 30 years, was ousted on February 11, 2011. The fates of the regimes in Bahrain, Libya, Syria, and Yemen are unknown as we complete this preface. The roots of discontent in these countries lie in their poverty. The average Egyptian has an income level of around 12% of the average citizen of the United States and can expect to live 10 fewer years. 20% of the population is in dire poverty. Though these differences are significant, they are actually quite small compared with those between the United States and the poorest countries in the world, such as North Korea, Sierra Leone, and Zimbabwe, where well over half the population lives in poverty. Why is Egypt so much poorer than the United States? What are the constraints that keep Egyptians from becoming more prosperous? Is the poverty of Egypt immutable? Or can it be eradicated? A natural way to start thinking about this is to look at what the Egyptians themselves are saying about the problems they face and why they rose up against the Mubarak regime. Noah Hamed, 24, a worker at an advertising agency in Cairo, made her views clear as she demonstrated in Tahrir Square. "We are suffering from corruption, oppression, and bad education. We are living amid a corrupt system which has to change." Another in the square, Mossab El-Shami, 20, a pharmacy student, concurred. "I hope that by the end of this year we will have an elected government and that universal freedoms are applied and that we put an end to the corruption that has taken over this country." The protesters in Tahrir Square spoke with one voice about the corruption of the government, its inability to deliver public services, and the lack of equality of opportunity in their country. They particularly complained about repression and the absence of political rights. As Mohamed El-Barade, former director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, wrote on Twitter on January 13, 2011, "Tunisia, repression plus absence of social justice plus denial of channels for peaceful change equals a ticking bomb." Egyptians and Tunisians both saw their economic problems as being fundamentally caused by their lack of political rights. When the protesters started to formulate their demands more systematically, the first 12 immediate demands posted by Wel Khalil, the software engineer and blogger who emerged as one of the leaders of the Egyptian protest movement, were all focused on political change. Issues such as raising the minimum wage appeared only among the transitional demands that were to be implemented later. To Egyptians, the things that have held them back include an ineffective and corrupt state, and a society where they cannot use their talent, ambition, ingenuity, and what education they can get. But they also recognize that the roots of these problems are political. All the economic impediments they face stem from the way political power in Egypt is exercised and monopolized by a narrow elite. This, they understand, is the first thing that has to change. Yet in believing this, the protesters of Tahrir Square have sharply diverged from the conventional wisdom on this topic. When they reason about why a country such as Egypt is poor, most academics and commentators emphasize completely different factors. Some stress that Egypt's poverty is determined primarily by its geography, by the fact that the country is mostly a desert and lacks adequate rainfall, and that its soils and climate do not allow productive agriculture. Others instead point to cultural attributes of Egyptians that are supposedly inimical to economic development and prosperity. Egyptians, they argue, lack the same sort of work ethic and cultural traits that have allowed others to prosper, and instead have accepted Islamic beliefs that are inconsistent with economic success. A third approach, the one dominant among economists and policy pundits, is based on the notion that the rulers of Egypt simply don't know what is needed to make their country prosperous, and have followed incorrect policies and strategies in the past. If these rulers would only get the right advice from the right advisors, the thinking goes, prosperity would follow. To these academics and pundits, the fact that Egypt has been ruled by narrow elites feathering their nests at the expense of society seems irrelevant to understanding the country's economic problems. In this book, we'll argue that the Egyptians in Tahrir Square, not most academics and commentators, have the right idea. In fact, Egypt is poor precisely because it has been ruled by a narrow elite that have organized society for their own benefit at the expense of the vast mass of people. Political power has been narrowly concentrated and has been used to create great wealth for those who possess it, such as the $70 billion fortune apparently accumulated by ex-President Mubarak. The losers have been the Egyptian people, as they only too well understand. We'll show that this interpretation of Egyptian poverty, the people's interpretation, turns out to provide a general explanation for why poor countries are poor. Whether it is North Korea, Sierra Leone, or Zimbabwe, we'll show that poor countries are poor for the same reason that Egypt is poor. Countries such as Great Britain and the United States became rich because their citizens overthrew the elites who controlled power and created a society where political rights were much more broadly distributed, where the government was accountable and responsive to citizens, and where the great mass of people could take advantage of economic opportunities. We'll show that to understand why there is such inequality in the world today, we have to delve into the past and study the historical dynamics of societies. We'll see that the reason that Britain is richer than Egypt is because in 1688, Britain, or England to be exact, had a revolution that transformed the politics and thus the economics of the nation. People fought for and won more political rights, and they used them to expand their economic opportunities. The result was a fundamentally different political and economic trajectory, culminating in the Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution and the technologies it unleashed didn't spread to Egypt, as that country was under the control of the Ottoman Empire, which treated Egypt in rather the same way as the Mubarak family later did. Ottoman rule in Egypt was overthrown by Napoleon Bonaparte in 1798, but the country then fell under the control of British colonialism, which had as little interest as the Ottomans in promoting Egypt's prosperity. Though the Egyptians shook off the Ottoman and British empires and, in 1952, overthrew their monarchy, these were not revolutions like that of 1688 in England, and rather than fundamentally transforming politics in Egypt, they brought to power another elite, as disinterested in achieving prosperity for ordinary Egyptians as the Ottoman and British had been. In consequence, the basic structure of society did not change, and Egypt stayed poor. In this book, we'll study how these patterns reproduce themselves over time, and why sometimes they are altered, as they were in England in 1688 and in France with the Revolution of 1789. This will help us to understand if the situation in Egypt has changed today, and whether the revolution that overthrew Mubarak will lead to a new set of institutions capable of bringing prosperity to ordinary Egyptians. Egypt has had revolutions in the past that did not change things, because those who mounted the revolutions simply took over the reins from those they deposed and recreated a similar system. It is indeed difficult for ordinary citizens to acquire real political power and change the way their society works, but it is possible. And we'll see how this happened in England, France, and the United States, and also in Japan, Botswana, and Brazil. Fundamentally, It is a political transformation of this sort that is required for a poor society to become rich. There is evidence that this may be happening in Egypt. Reda Metwali, another protester in Tahrir, argued, "Now you see Muslims and Christians together. Now you see old and young together, all wanting the same thing." We'll see that such a broad movement in society was a key part of what happened in these other political transformations. If we understand when and why such transitions occur, we will be in a better position to evaluate when we expect such movements to fail, as they have often done in the past, and when we may hope that they will succeed and improve the lives of millions. Chapter 1. So Close and Yet So Different. The Economics of the Rio Grande. The city of Nogales is cut in half by a fence. If you stand by it and look north, you'll see Nogales, Arizona, located in Santa Cruz County. The income of the average household there is about $30,000 a year. Most teenagers are in school, and the majority of the adults are high school graduates. Despite all the arguments people make about how deficient the U.S. healthcare system is, the population is relatively healthy, with high life expectancy by global standards. Many of the residents are above age 65 and have access to Medicare. It's just one of the many services the government provides that most take for granted, such as electricity, telephones, a sewage system, public health, a road network linking them to other cities in the area and to the rest of the United States, and last but not least, law and order. The people of Nogales, Arizona can go about their daily activities without fear for life or safety and not constantly afraid of theft, expropriation, or other things that might jeopardize their investments in their businesses and houses. Equally important, the residents of Nogales, Arizona take it for granted that with all its inefficiency and occasional corruption, the government is their agent. They can vote to replace their mayor, congressmen, and senators. They vote in the presidential elections that determine who will lead their country. Democracy is second nature to them. Life south of the fence, just a few feet away, is rather different. While the residents of Nogales, Sonora live in a relatively prosperous part of Mexico, the income of the average household there is about one-third that in Nogales, Arizona. Most adults in Nogales, Sonora do not have a high school degree, and many teenagers are not in school. Mothers have to worry about high rates of infant mortality. Poor public health conditions mean it's no surprise that the residents of Nogales, Sonora do not live as long as their northern neighbors. They also don't have access to many public amenities. Roads are in bad condition south of the fence. Law and order is in worse condition. Crime is high, and opening a business is a risky activity. Not only do you risk robbery, but getting all the permissions and greasing all the palms just to open is no easy endeavor. Residents of Nogales, Sonora live with politicians' corruption and ineptitude every day. In contrast to their northern neighbors, democracy is a very recent experience for them. Until the political reforms of 2000, Nogales, Sonora, just like the rest of Mexico, was under the corrupt control of the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or Partido Revolucionario Institucional, PRI. How could the two halves of what is essentially the same city be so different? There is no difference in geography, climate, or the types of diseases prevalent in the area, since germs do not face any restrictions crossing back and forth between the United States and Mexico. Of course, health conditions are very different, but this has nothing to do with the disease environment. It is because the people south of the border live with inferior sanitary conditions and lack decent health care. But perhaps the residents are very different. Could it be that the residents of Nogales, Arizona are grandchildren of migrants from Europe, while those in the south are descendants of Aztecs? Not so. The backgrounds of people on both sides of the border are quite similar. After Mexico became independent from Spain in 1821, the area around Los Dos Nogales was part of the Mexican state of Vieja California and remained so even after the Mexican-American War of 1848. Indeed, it was only after the Gadsden Purchase of 1853 that the U.S. border was extended into this area. It was Lieutenant Ann Mitchler who, while surveying the border, noted the presence of the pretty little valley of Los Nogales. Here, on either side of the border, the two cities rose up. The inhabitants of Nogales, Arizona, and Nogales, Sonora, share ancestors, enjoy the same food and the same music, and, we would hazard to say, have the same culture. Of course, there is a very simple and obvious explanation for the differences between the two halves of Nogales that you've probably long since guessed. The very border that defines the two halves. Nogales, Arizona is in the United States. Its inhabitants have access to the economic institutions of the United States, which enable them to choose their occupations freely, acquire schooling and skills, and encourage their employers to invest in the best technology, which leads to higher wages for them. They also have access to political institutions that allow them to take part in the democratic process, to elect their representatives, and replace them if they misbehave. In consequence, politicians provide the basic services, ranging from public health to roads to law and order, that the citizens demand. Those of Nogales, Sonora are not so lucky. They live in a different world, shaped by different institutions. These different institutions create very disparate incentives for the inhabitants of the two Nogaleses and for the entrepreneurs and businesses willing to invest there. These incentives created by the different institutions of the Nogaleses and the countries in which they are situated are the main reason for the differences in economic prosperity on the two sides of the border. Why are the institutions of the United States so much more conducive to economic success than those of Mexico, or, for that matter, the rest of Latin America? The answer to this question lies in the way the different societies formed during the early colonial period. An institutional divergence took place then, with implications lasting into the present day. To understand this divergence, we must begin right at the foundation of the colonies in North and Latin America. The founding of Buenos Aires. Early in 1516, the Spanish navigator Juan Díaz de Solís sailed into a wide estuary on the eastern seaboard of South America. Wading ashore, de Solís claimed the land for Spain, naming the river the Río de la Plata, River of Silver, since the local Indians possessed silver. The indigenous peoples on either side of the estuary, the Charrúas in what is now Uruguay, and the Carandí on the plains that were to be known as the Pampas in modern Argentina, regarded the newcomers with hostility. These locals were hunter-gatherers who lived in small groups without strong centralized political authorities. Indeed, it was such a band of Charrúas who clubbed de Solís to death as he explored the new domains he had attempted to occupy for Spain. In 1534, the Spanish, still optimistic, sent out a first mission of settlers from Spain under the leadership of Pedro de Mendoza. They founded a town on the site of Buenos Aires in the same year. It should have been an ideal place for Europeans. Buenos Aires, literally meaning good airs, had a hospitable, temperate climate. Yet the first stay of the Spaniards there was short-lived. They were not after good airs, but resources to extract and labor to coerce. The Charrúas and the Carandí were not obliging, however. They refused to provide food to the Spaniards and refused to work when caught. They attacked the new settlement with their bows and arrows. The Spaniards grew hungry, since they had not anticipated having to provide food for themselves. Buenos Aires was not what they had dreamed of. The local Indians could not be forced into providing labor. The area had no silver or gold to exploit. And the silver that de Solís found had actually come all the way from the Inca state in the Andes, far to the west. The Spaniards, while trying to survive, started sending out expeditions to find a new place that would offer greater riches and populations easier to coerce. In 1537, one of these expeditions, under the leadership of Juan de Ayolas, penetrated up the Paraná River, searching for a route to the Incas. On its way, it made contact with the Guarani, a sedentary people with an agricultural economy based on maize and cassava. De Ayolas immediately realized that the Guarani were a completely different proposition from the Charrúas and the Carandí. After a brief conflict, he overcame Guarani resistance and founded a town, Nuestra Señora de Santa María de la Asunción, which remains the capital of Paraguay today. De Ayolas and his men married the Guarani princesses, and quickly set themselves up as a new aristocracy. They adapted the existing systems of forced labor and tribute of the Guarani, with themselves at the helm. This was the kind of colony they wanted to set up, and within 4 years, Buenos Aires was abandoned, as all the Spaniards who'd settled there moved to the new town. Buenos Aires, the Paris of South America, a city of wide European-style boulevards based on the great agricultural wealth of the Pampas, was not resettled until 1580. The abandonment of Buenos Aires and the conquest of the Guarani reveals the logic of European colonization of the Americas. Early Spanish, and as we will see, English colonists, were not interested in tilling the soil themselves. They wanted others to do it for them, and they wanted riches, gold and silver, to plunder. From Cajamarca. The expeditions of de Solís, de Mendoza, and de Ayolas came in the wake of more famous ones that followed Christopher Columbus's sighting of one of the islands of the Bahamas on October 12, 1492. Spanish expansion and colonization of the Americas began in earnest with the invasion of Mexico by Hernán Cortés in 1519, the expedition of Francisco Pizarro to Peru a decade and a half later, and the expedition of Pedro de Mendoza to the Rio de la Plata just 2 years after that. Over the next century, Spain conquered and colonized most of Central, Western, and Southern South America, while Portugal claimed Brazil to the east. The Spanish strategy of colonization was highly effective, first perfected by Cortés in Mexico. It was based on the observation that the best way for the Spanish to subdue opposition was to capture the Indian leader. This strategy enabled the Spanish to claim the accumulated wealth of the leader and coerce the indigenous peoples to give tribute and food. The next step was setting themselves up as the new elite of the indigenous society and taking control of the existing methods of taxation, tribute, and particularly forced labor. When Cortés and his men arrived at the great Aztec capital of Tenochtitlan on November 8, 1519, they were welcomed by Moctezuma, the Aztec emperor, who had decided, in the face of much advice from his counselors, to welcome the Spaniards peacefully. What happened next is well described by the account compiled after 1545 by the Franciscan priest Bernardino de Sahagún in his famous Florentine Codices. At once they, the Spanish, firmly seized Moctezuma. Then each of the guns shot off. Fear prevailed. It was as if everyone had swallowed his heart. Even before it had grown dark, there was terror, there was astonishment, there was apprehension, there was a stunning of the people. And when it dawned, thereupon were proclaimed all the things which the Spaniards required: white tortillas, roasted turkey hens, eggs, fresh water, wood, firewood, charcoal. This had Moctezuma indeed commanded. And when the Spaniards were well settled, they thereupon inquired of Moctezuma as to all the city's treasure. With great zeal, they sought gold. And Moctezuma thereupon went leading the Spaniards. They were surrounding him, each holding him, each grasping him. And when they reached the storehouse, a place called Teocalco, thereupon they brought forth all the brilliant things, the Quetzal feather head fan, the devices, the shields, the golden discs, the golden nose crescents, the golden leg bands, the golden arm bands, the golden forehead bands. Thereupon was detached the gold. At once they ignited, set fire to all the precious things. They all burned, and the gold the Spaniards formed into separate bars, and the Spanish walked everywhere. They took all that they saw, which they saw to be good. Thereupon they went to Moctezuma's own storehouse, at the place called Totocalco. They brought forth Moctezuma's own property, precious things all, the necklaces with pendants, the armbands with tufts of quetzal feathers, the golden armbands, the bracelets, the golden bands with shells, and the turquoise diadem, the attribute of the ruler. They took it all. The military conquest of the Aztecs was completed by 1521. Cortes, as governor of the province of New Spain, then began dividing up the most valuable resource, the indigenous population, through the institution of the encomienda. The encomienda had first appeared in 15th century Spain as part of the reconquest of the south of the country from the Moors, Arabs who had settled during and after the 8th century. In the New World, it took on a much more pernicious form. It was a grant of indigenous peoples to a Spaniard, known as the encomendero. The indigenous peoples had to give the encomendero tribute and labor services, in exchange for which the encomendero was charged with converting them to Christianity. A vivid early account of the workings of the encomienda has come down to us from Bartolomé de las Casas, a Dominican priest who formulated the earliest and one of the most devastating critiques of the Spanish colonial system. De las Casas arrived on the Spanish island of Hispaniola in 1502, with a fleet of ships led by the new governor, Nicolás de Ovando. He became increasingly disillusioned and disturbed by the cruel and exploitative treatment of the indigenous peoples he witnessed every day. In 1513, he took part as a chaplain in the Spanish conquest of Cuba, even being granted an encomienda for his service. However, he renounced the grant and began a long campaign to reform Spanish colonial institutions. His efforts culminated in his book, A Short Account of the Destruction of the Indies, written in 1542, a withering attack on the barbarity of Spanish rule. On the encomienda, he has this to say in the case of Nicaragua. Each of the settlers took up residence in the town allotted to him, or encomended to him, as the legal phrase has it, put the inhabitants to work for him, stole their already scarce foodstuffs for himself, and took over the lands owned and worked by the natives, and on which they traditionally grew their own produce. The settler would treat the whole of the native population, dignitaries, old men, women, and children, as members of his household, and as such, make them labor night and day in his own interests, without any rest whatsoever. For the conquest of New Granada, modern Colombia, de las Casas reports the whole Spanish strategy in action. To realize their long-term purpose of seizing all the available gold, the Spaniards employed their usual strategy of apportioning among themselves, or encomending, as they have it, the towns and their inhabitants, and then, as ever, treating them as common slaves. The man in overall command of the expedition seized the king of the whole territory for himself and held him prisoner for 6 or 7 months, quite illicitly demanding more and more gold and emeralds from him. This king, one Bogotá, was so terrified that in his anxiety to free himself from the clutches of his tormentors, he consented to the demand that he fill an entire house with gold and hand it over. To this end, he sent his people off in search of gold, and bit by bit they brought it along with many precious stones. But still, the house was not filled, and the Spaniards eventually declared that they would put him to death for breaking his promise. The commander suggested they should bring the case before him as a representative of the law, and when they did so, entering formal accusations against the king, he sentenced him to torture should he persist in not honoring the bargain. They tortured him with a estrapado, put burning tallow on his belly, pinned both his legs to poles with iron hoops and his neck with another, and then, with two men holding his hands, proceeded to burn the soles of his feet. From time to time, the commander would look in and repeat that they would torture him to death, slowly, unless he produced more gold. And this is what they did, the king eventually succumbing to the agonies they inflicted on him. The strategy and institutions of conquest perfected in Mexico were eagerly adopted elsewhere in the Spanish Empire. Nowhere was this done more effectively than in Pizarro's conquest of Peru, as de las Casas begins his account. In 1531, another great villain journeyed with a number of men to the Kingdom of Peru. He set out with every intention of imitating the strategy and tactics of his fellow adventurers in other parts of the New World. Pizarro began on the coast near the Peruvian town of Tumbes and marched south. On November 15, 1532, he reached the mountain town of Cajamarca, where the Inca Emperor Atahualpa was encamped with his army. The next day, Atahualpa, who who had just vanquished his brother Huascar in a contest over who would succeed their deceased father, Huanacapac, came with his retinue to where the Spanish were camped. Atahualpa was irritated because news of atrocities that the Spanish had already committed, such as violating a temple of the sun god Inti, had reached him. What transpired next is well known. The Spanish laid a trap and sprang it. They killed Atahualpa's guards and retainers, possibly as many as 2,000 people, and captured the king. To gain his freedom, Atahualpa had to promise to fill one room with gold and two more of the same size with silver. He did this, but the Spanish, reneging on their promises, strangled him in July 1533. That November, the Spanish captured the Inca capital of Cusco, where the Incan aristocracy received the same treatment as Atahualpa, being imprisoned until they produced gold and silver. When they did not satisfy Spanish demands, they were burned alive. The great artistic treasures of Cusco, such as the Temple of the Sun, had their gold stripped from them and melted down into ingots. At this point, the Spanish focused on the people of the Inca Empire. As in Mexico, citizens were divided into encomiendas, with one going to each of the conquistadors who had accompanied Pizarro. The encomienda was the main institution used for the control and organization of labor in the early colonial period, but it soon faced a vigorous contender. In 1545, a local named Diego Gualpa was searching for an indigenous shrine high in the Andes, in what is today Bolivia. He was thrown to the ground by a sudden gust of wind, and in front of him appeared a cache of silver ore. This was part of a vast mountain of silver, which the Spanish baptized El Cerro Rico, the Rich Hill. Around it grew the city of Potosí, which at its height in 1650 had a population of 160,000 people, larger than Lisbon or Venice in this period. To exploit the silver, the Spanish needed miners, a lot of miners. They sent a new viceroy, the chief Spanish colonial official Francisco de Toledo, whose main mission was to solve the labor problem. De Toledo, arriving in Peru in 1569, first spent 5 years traveling around and investigating his new charge. He also commissioned a massive survey of the entire adult population. To find the labor he needed, De Toledo first moved almost the entire indigenous population, concentrating them in new towns called reducciones, literally reductions, which would facilitate the exploitation of labor by the Spanish crown. Then he revived and adapted an Incan labor institution known as the Mita, which in the Incas language, Quechua, means a turn. Under their Mita system, the Incas had used forced labor to run plantations designed to provide food for temples, the aristocracy, and the army. In return, the Inca elite provided famine relief and security. In De Toledo's hands, the Mita, especially the Potosí Mita, was to become the largest and most onerous scheme of labor exploitation in the Spanish colonial period. De Toledo defined a huge catchment area, running from the middle of modern-day Peru and encompassing most of modern Bolivia. It covered about 200,000 square miles. In this area, one-seventh of the male inhabitants, newly arrived in their reducciones, were required to work in the mines at Potosí. The Potosí Mita endured throughout the entire colonial period and was abolished only in 1825. Map 1 shows the catchment area of the Mita, superimposed on the extent of the Inca Empire at the time of the Spanish conquest. It illustrates the extent to which the Mita overlapped with the heartland of the empire, encompassing the capital, Cusco. Remarkably, you still see the legacy of the Mita in Peru today. Take the differences between the provinces of Calca and nearby Acomayo. There appears to be few differences among these provinces. Both are high in the mountains, and each is inhabited by the Quechua-speaking descendants of the Incas. Yet Acomayo is much poorer, with its inhabitants consuming about one-third less than those in Calca. The people know this. In Acomayo, they ask intrepid foreigners, "Don't you know that the people here are poorer than the people over there in Calca? Why would you ever want to come here?" Intrepid, because it is much harder to get to Acomayo from the regional capital of Cusco, ancient center of the Inca Empire, than it is to get to Calca. The road to Calca is surfaced. The one to Acomayo is in a terrible state of disrepair. To get beyond Acomayo, you need a horse or a mule. In Calca and Acomayo, people grow the same crops, but in Calca, they sell them on the market for money. In Acomayo, they grow food for their own subsistence. These inequalities, apparent to the eye and to the people who live there, can be understood in terms of the institutional differences between these departments. Institutional differences with historical roots going back to De Toledo and his plan for effective exploitation of indigenous labor. The major historical difference between Acomayo and Calca is that Acomayo was in the catchment area of the Potosí Mita. Calca was not. In addition to the concentration of labor and the Mita, De Toledo consolidated the encomienda into a head tax, a fixed sum, payable by each adult male every year in silver. This was another scheme designed to force people into the labor market and reduce wages for Spanish landowners. Another institution, the Repartimiento de Mercancias, also became widespread during De Toledo's tenure. Derived from the Spanish verb repartir, to distribute, this repartimiento, literally the distribution of goods, involved the forced sale of goods to Indians at prices determined by Spaniards. Finally, De Toledo introduced the trajín, meaning literally the burden, which used the indigenous people to carry heavy loads of goods, such as wine or coca leaves or textiles, as a substitute for pack animals, for the business ventures of the Spanish elite. Throughout the Spanish colonial world in the Americas, similar institutions and social structures emerged. After an initial phase of looting and gold and silver lust, the Spanish created a web of institutions designed to exploit the indigenous peoples. The full gamut of encomienda, mita, repartimiento, and trajín was designed to force indigenous peoples' living standards down to a subsistence level, and thus extract all income in excess of this for Spaniards. This was achieved by expropriating their land, forcing them to work, offering low wages for labor services, imposing high taxes, and charging high prices for goods that were not even voluntarily bought. Though these institutions generated a lot of wealth for the Spanish crown and made the conquistadors and their descendants very rich, they also turned Latin America into the most unequal continent in the world and sapped much of its economic potential. To Jamestown. As the Spanish began their conquest of the Americas in the 1490s, England was a minor European power recovering from the devastating effects of a civil war, the Wars of the Roses. She was in no state to take advantage of the scramble for loot and gold, and the opportunity to exploit the indigenous peoples of the Americas. Nearly 100 years later, in 1588, the lucky rout of the Spanish Armada, an attempt by King Philip II of Spain to invade England, sent political shockwaves around Europe. Fortunate though England's victory was, it was also a sign of growing English assertiveness on the seas that would enable them to finally take part in the quest for colonial empire. It is thus no coincidence that the English began their colonization of North America at exactly the same time. But they were already latecomers. They chose North America, not because it was attractive, but because it was all that was available. The desirable parts of the Americas, where the indigenous population to exploit was plentiful, and where the gold and silver mines were located, had already been occupied. The English got the leftovers. When the 18th century English writer and agriculturalist Arthur Young discussed where profitable staple products, by which he meant exportable agricultural goods, were produced, he noted, "It appears upon the whole that the staple productions of our colonies decrease in value in proportion to their distance from the sun. In the West Indies, which are the hottest of all, they make to the amount of £8.12.1 per head. In the southern continental ones, to the amount of £5.10. In the central ones, to the amount of £9.65. In the northern settlements, to that of £2.06. This scale surely suggests a most important lesson, to avoid colonizing in northern latitudes." The first English attempt to plant a colony at Roanoke in North Carolina between 1585 and 1587 was a complete failure. In 1607, they tried again. Shortly before the end of 1606, three vessels, Susan Constant, Godspeed, and Discovery, under the command of Captain Christopher Newport, set off for Virginia. The colonists, under the auspices of the Virginia Company, sailed into Chesapeake Bay and up a river they named the James, after the ruling English monarch James I. On May 14, 1607, they founded the settlement of Jamestown. Though the settlers on board the ships owned by the Virginia Company were English, they had a model of colonization heavily influenced by the template set up by Cortes, Pizarro, and de Toledo. Their first plan was to capture the local chief and use him as a way to get provisions and to coerce the population into producing food and wealth for them. When they first landed in Jamestown, the English colonists did not know that they were within the territory claimed by the Powhatan Confederacy, a coalition of some 30 polities, owing allegiance to a king called Wahunsunacock. Wahunsunacock's capital was at the town of Werowocomoco, a mere 20 miles from Jamestown. The plan of the colonists was to learn more about the lay of the land. If the locals could not be induced to provide food and labor, the colonists might at least be able to trade with them. The notion that the settlers themselves would work and grow their own food seems not to have crossed their minds. That is not what conquerors of the New World did. Wahunsunacock quickly became aware of the colonist presence and viewed their intentions with great suspicion. He was in charge of what for North America was quite a large empire. But he had many enemies and lacked the overwhelming centralized political control of the Incas. Wahunsunacock decided to see what the intentions of the English were, initially sending messengers, saying that he desired friendly relations with them. As the winter of 1607 closed in, the settlers in Jamestown began to run low on food, and the appointed leader of the colony's ruling council, Edward Marie Wingfield, dithered indecisively. The situation was rescued by Captain John Smith. Smith, whose writings provide one of our main sources of information about the early development of the colony, was a larger-than-life character. Born in England, in rural Lincolnshire, he disregarded his father's desires for him to go into business, and instead became a soldier of fortune. He first fought with English armies in the Netherlands, after which he joined Austrian forces serving in Hungary, fighting against the armies of the Ottoman Empire. Captured in Romania, he was sold as a slave and put to work as a field hand. He managed one day to overcome his master, and stealing his clothes and his horse, escaped back into Austrian territory. Smith had already gotten himself into trouble on the voyage to Virginia, and was imprisoned on the Susan Constant for mutiny after defying the orders of Wingfield. When the ships reached the New World, the plan was to put him on trial. To the immense horror of Wingfield, Newport, and other elite colonists, however, when they opened their sealed orders, they discovered that the Virginia Company had nominated Smith to be a member of the ruling council that was to govern Jamestown. With Newport sailing back to England for supplies and more colonists, and Wingfield uncertain about what to do, it was Smith who saved the colony. He initiated a series of trading missions that secured vital food supplies. On one of these, he was captured by Opechancanough, one of Wahunsunacock's younger brothers, and was brought before the king at Werowocomoco. He was the first Englishman to meet Wahunsunacock, and it was at this initial meeting that, according to some accounts, Smith's life was saved only at the intervention of Wahunsunacock's young daughter, Pocahontas. Freed on January 2, 1608, Smith returned to Jamestown, which was still perilously low on food, until the timely return of Newport from England later on the same day. The colonists of Jamestown learned little from this initial experience. As 1608 proceeded, they continued their quest for gold and precious metals. They still did not seem to understand that, to survive, they could not rely on the Indians to feed them through either coercion or trade. It was Smith who was the first to realize that the model of colonization that had worked so well for Cortes and Pizarro simply would not work in North America. The underlying circumstances were just too different. Smith noted that, unlike the Aztecs and Incas, the Indians of Virginia did not have gold. Indeed, he noted in his diary, "Victuals, you must know, is all their wealth." Honest Todkill, one of the early settlers who left an extensive diary, expressed well the frustrations of Smith and the few others on which this recognition dawned. "There was no talk, no hope, no work but dig gold, refine gold, load gold." When Newport sailed for England in April 1608, he took a cargo of pyrite, fool's gold. He returned at the end of September with orders from the Virginia Company to take firmer control over the local Indians. Their plan was to crown Wahoonsunacock, hoping this would render him subservient to the English King James I. They invited him to Jamestown, but Wahoonsunacock, still deeply suspicious of the colonists, had no intention of risking capture. John Smith recorded Wahoonsunacock's reply, "If your king have sent me presents, I also am a king, and this is my land. Your father is to come to me, not I to him, nor yet to your fort, neither will I bite at such a bait." If Wahoonsunacock would not bite at such a bait, Newport and Smith would have to go to Werowocomoco to undertake the coronation. The whole event appears to have been a complete fiasco, with the only thing coming out of it a resolve on the part of Wahoonsunacock that it was time to get rid of the colony. He imposed a trade embargo. Jamestown could no longer trade for supplies. Wahoonsunacock would starve them out. Newport set sail once more for England in December 1608. He took with him a letter written by Smith pleading with the directors of the Virginia Company to change the way they thought about the colony. There was no possibility of a get-rich-quick exploitation of Virginia along the lines of Mexico and Peru. There were no gold or precious metals, and the indigenous people could not be forced to work or provide food. Smith realized that if there were going to be a viable colony, it was the colonists who would have to work. He therefore pleaded with the directors to send the right sort of people. "When you send again, I entreat you, rather, to send some 30 carpenters, husbandmen, gardeners, fishermen, blacksmiths, masons, and diggers up of trees, roots, well provided, than 1,000 of such as we have." Smith did not want any more useless goldsmiths. Once more, Jamestown survived only because of his resourcefulness. He managed to cajole and bully Indian tribes to trade with him, and when they wouldn't, he took what he could. Back in the settlement, Smith was completely in charge and imposed the rule that he that will not work shall not eat. Jamestown survived a second winter. The Virginia Company was intended to be a money-making enterprise, and after two disastrous years, there was no whiff of profit. The directors of the company decided that they needed a new model of governance, replacing the ruling council with a single governor. The first man appointed to this position was Sir Thomas Gates. Heeding some aspects of Smith's warning, the company realized that they had to try something new. This realization was driven home by the events of the winter of 1609 into 1610, the so-called starving time. The new mode of governance left no room for Smith, who, disgruntled, returned to England in the autumn of 1609. Without his resourcefulness, and with Wahoonsunacock throttling the food supply, the colonists in Jamestown perished. Of the 500 who entered the winter, only 60 were alive by March. The situation was so desperate that they resorted to cannibalism. The something new that was imposed on the colony by Gates and his deputy, Sir Thomas Dale, was a work regime of draconian severity for English settlers, though not, of course, for the elite running the colony. It was Dale who propagated the laws divine, moral and martial. This included the clauses, "No man or woman shall run away from the colony to the Indians upon pain of death. Anyone who robs a garden, public or private, or a vineyard, or who steals ears of corn, shall be punished with death. No member of the colony will sell or give any commodity of this country to a captain, mariner, master, or sailor to transport out of the colony for his own private uses, upon pain of death." If the indigenous peoples could not be exploited, reasoned the Virginia Company, perhaps the colonists could. The new model of colonial development entailed the Virginia Company owning all the land. Men were housed in barracks and given company-determined rations. Work gangs were chosen, each one overseen by an agent of the company. It was close to martial law, with execution as the punishment of first resort. As part of the new institutions for the colony, the first clause just given is significant. The company threatened with death those who ran away. Given the new work regime, running away to live with the locals became more and more of an attractive option for the colonists who had to do the work. Also available, given the low density of even indigenous populations in Virginia at that time, was the prospect of going it alone on the frontier beyond the control of the Virginia Company. The power of the company in the face of these options was limited. It could not coerce the English settlers into hard work at subsistence rations. Map 2 shows an estimate of the population density of different regions of the Americas at the time of the Spanish conquest. The population density of the United States, outside of a few pockets, was at most 3/4 of a person per square mile. In central Mexico, or Andean Peru, the population density was as high as 400 people per square mile, more than 500 times higher. It took the Virginia Company some time to recognize that its initial model of colonization did not work in Virginia. And it took a while, too, for the failure of the laws divine, moral, and martial to sink in. Starting in 1618, a dramatically new strategy was adopted. Since it was possible to coerce neither the locals nor the settlers, the only alternative was to give the settlers incentives. In 1618, the company began the headright system, which gave each male settler 50 acres of land and 50 more acres for each member of his family and for all servants that a family could bring to Virginia. Settlers were given their houses and freed from their contracts, and in 1619, a general assembly was introduced that effectively gave all adult men a say in the laws and institutions governing the colony. It was the start of democracy in the United States. It took the Virginia Company 12 years to learn its first lesson that what had worked for the Spanish in Mexico and in Central and South America would not work in the North. The rest of the 17th century saw a long series of struggles over the second lesson, that the only option for an economically viable colony was to create institutions that gave the colonists incentives to invest and to work hard. As North America developed, English elites tried time and time again to set up institutions that would heavily restrict the economic and political rights for all but a privileged few of the inhabitants of the colony, just as the Spanish did. Yet in each case, this model broke down, as it had in Virginia. One of the most ambitious attempts began soon after the change in strategy of the Virginia Company. In 1632, 10 million acres of land on the upper Chesapeake Bay were granted by the English King Charles I to Cecilius Calvert, Lord Baltimore. The Charter of Maryland gave Lord Baltimore complete freedom to create a government along any lines he wished, with Clause 7 noting that Baltimore had, for the good and happy government of the said province, free, full, and absolute power, by the tenor of these presents, to ordain, make, and enact laws of what kind soever. Baltimore drew up a detailed plan for creating a manorial society, a North American variant of an idealized version of 17th century rural England. It entailed dividing the land into plots of thousands of acres, which would be run by lords. The lords would recruit tenants, who would work the lands and pay rents to the privileged elite controlling the land. Another similar attempt was made later in 1663, with the founding of Carolina by 8 proprietors, including Sir Anthony Ashley Cooper. Ashley Cooper, along with his secretary, the great English philosopher John Locke, formulated the Fundamental Constitutions of Carolina. This document, like the Charter of Maryland before it, provided a blueprint for an elitist, hierarchical society based on control by a landed elite. The preamble noted that the government of this province may be made most agreeable to the monarchy under which we live, and of which this province is a part, and that we may avoid erecting a numerous democracy. The clauses of the Fundamental Constitutions laid out a rigid social structure. At the bottom were the leetmen, with Clause 23 noting, All the children of Leetmen shall be Leetmen, and so to all generations. Above the Leetmen, who had no political power, were the Landgraves and Caziques, who were to form the aristocracy. Landgraves were to be allocated 48,000 acres of land each, and Caziques 24,000 acres. There was to be a parliament in which Landgraves and Caziques were represented, but it would be permitted to debate only those measures that had previously been approved by the 8 proprietors. Just as the attempt to impose draconian rule in Virginia failed, so did the plans for the same type of institutions in Maryland and Carolina. The reasons were similar. In all cases, it proved to be impossible to force settlers into a rigid, hierarchical society, because there were simply too many options open to them in the New World. Instead, they had to be provided with incentives for them to want to work. And soon, they were demanding more economic freedom and further political rights. In Maryland, too, settlers insisted on getting their own land, and they forced Lord Baltimore into creating an assembly. In 1691, the assembly induced the king to declare Maryland a crown colony, thus removing the political privileges of Baltimore and his great lords. A similar protracted struggle took place in the Carolinas, again with the proprietors losing. South Carolina became a royal colony in 1729. By the 1720s, all the 13 colonies of what was to become the United States had similar structures of government. In all cases, there was a governor and an assembly based on a franchise of male property holders. They were not democracies. Women, slaves, and the propertyless could not vote. But political rights were very broad compared with contemporary societies elsewhere. It was these assemblies and their leaders that coalesced to form the First Continental Congress in 1774, the prelude to the independence of the United States. The assemblies believed that they had the right to determine both their own membership and the right to taxation. This, as we know, created problems for the English colonial government. A Tale of Two Constitutions. It should now be apparent that it is not a coincidence that the United States, and not Mexico, adopted and enforced a constitution that espoused democratic principles, created limitations on the use of political power, and distributed that power broadly in society. The document that the delegates sat down to write in Philadelphia in May 1787 was the outcome of a long process initiated by the formation of the General Assembly in Jamestown in 1619. The contrast between the constitutional process that took place at the time of the independence of the United States and the one that took place a little afterward in Mexico is stark. In February 1808, Napoleon Bonaparte's French armies invaded Spain. By May, they had taken Madrid, the Spanish capital. By September, the Spanish King Ferdinand had been captured and had abdicated. A national junta, the Junta Central, took his place, taking the torch in the fight against the French. The junta met first at Aranjuez, but retreated south in the face of the French armies. Finally, it reached the port of Cadiz, which, though besieged by Napoleonic forces, held out. Here, the junta formed a parliament, called the Cortes. In 1812, the Cortes produced what became known as the Cadiz Constitution, which called for the introduction of a constitutional monarchy based on notions of popular sovereignty. It also called for the end of special privileges and the introduction of equality before the law. These demands were all anathema to the elites of South America, who were still ruling an institutional environment shaped by the encomienda, forced labor, and absolute power vested in them and the colonial state. The collapse of the Spanish state with the Napoleonic invasion created a constitutional crisis throughout colonial Latin America. There was much dispute about whether to recognize the authority of the Junta Central, and in response, many Latin Americans began to form their own juntas. It was only a matter of time before they began to sense the possibility of becoming truly independent from Spain. The first declaration of independence took place in La Paz, Bolivia, in 1809, though it was quickly crushed by Spanish troops sent from Peru. In Mexico, the political attitudes of the elite had been shaped by the 1810 Hidalgo Revolt, led by a priest, Father Miguel Hidalgo. When Hidalgo's army sacked Guanajuato on September 23rd, they killed the intendant, the senior colonial official, and then started indiscriminately to kill white people.